Now, you have a title. Now, theoretically, when you have a title on books or speeches or messages, you're not supposed to have more than 8 words. But I do have a little bit more than 8 words. And the title I have on this evening's message, and this will be more of a message, the following 2 weeks will probably be a little bit more of a teaching, so you can have comments. But this will tend to be a message. The title is Owning Nothing, Gaining Everything, A Bargain at Any Price. Owning nothing, gaining everything, a bargain at any price. Now, Jesus was nearing the end of his life, his earthly life, in the last year. The scripture says in Luke chapter 14, it says, "Now great crowds were going along with him, and he stopped. And he turned and said to them, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And if anyone does not carry his own cross and come after me, he cannot be my disciple. For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and consider whether he is able to complete it? Or else after he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, others who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, "This man began to build, but he's not able to finish." Or what king, when he sets out to go against another king in battle, will not first sit down and consider whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter him who is coming against him with 20,000. Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So then, none of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions." Now, I would suggest that this particular passage of Scripture and a couple others like it from the Gospels actually rings more fear in the heart of an individual than messages about hell itself and the fires in hell. See, Jesus brings us all up short, just like he brought the crowds up short, by saying, "Hey, you've got visions of grandeur. You've got visions of me being the Messiah, conquering the Romans, getting rid of the Roman taxation, the Roman presence, the Roman religion. You have visions of grandeur. A messianic kingdom like David or Solomon. But more than that, even bigger than that, ruling the world." But Jesus brought them all up short. It's way interesting the way the scripture puts it. It says the crowds, large crowds, were going along with him. Jesus had them eating out of his hands. But Jesus would always take those large crowds and he'd put them through a sieve, run them through a funnel, and squeeze them down to disciples, disciplined followers, those who were willing to pay a price. Now, it's interesting. We all see the signs at the stores, sometimes on the outside, sometimes the ad that comes through the mail in the newspaper, or sometimes a piece of mail. And it's sale, bargain, half price, clearance, closeout, 2-for-1, buy one, get one free, or buy one, get the second one for half price. That's the same as 25% off. We can all figure that out. But it gives that impression of buy one, get one free. Well, there are two of my favorites. The one that comes in the mail from JCPenney. And it says 25% off everything. And you turn it over and you look at the fine print in parentheses, except for cosmetics, except for catalog purchases, except for such and such and such. And so if you take that coupon to the store and go to the checkout line expecting this big discount, you find maybe only half the items you purchased actually qualify for that 25% off everything. Then my other favorite is the one that just says sale. What does that mean? The rest of the time it's not for sale? Well, we all know what they mean. They mean it's at a cheaper price than normal. But those are two of my favorites. And when it comes to church promotions, in the mega church crowd, there are a lot of people that are marketing the church. And that's the way they view it. And a lot of times they bring in the marketers to tell them how to market the church. The seeker-friendly church. The church where the carpet is thick, the air conditioning is cool, and the coffee is always hot and waiting for you. You come in, somebody there to greet you, give you a nice pamphlet, three-color pamphlet, giving you all the ministries of the church. You want a cup of coffee? Would you like French vanilla with that or hazelnut in your creamer? Coffee, tea, or me? And they preach a PMA gospel. Positive mental attitude. What God will do for you. But the question is, when they answer the critics, their answer is, well, you're one of those. You're legalistic. You're not adapting to the needs of the modern man. Now, the question is, what does Jesus require? Now, the text used the word own three times. Jesus could have said, if anyone does not hate his father or mother, but he puts emphasis on it. He says, own three times. Your own people, your own person, and your own family. There is no bargain in Christianity. You can't cheapen it. You can't make it easy for the next guy or gal. And too many people, that's the approach they're trying to take. They're trying to get somebody in. It's like rubbing Aladdin's lamp. If they just rub that lamp, then poof, they're presto chanzo Christian. You know, in the evangelical world, you know how they are. They try and get people on an emotional jag, and they get them to ask Jesus to come into their heart. It's like reading Christianity Today one time about a guy who was walking with another guy, and they stopped a kid on the street, and the one guy talked to this kid a little bit about Christ dying on the cross and got the kid in 5 minutes to ask Jesus into his heart. As they walked away, the guy said, that's the 20th youngster this month. And a lot of people have that concept. If you can just sort of talk them into it, get them to sign on the dotted line, then you've accomplished your task. But Jesus didn't operate that way. Not for you, not for me, not for them, and not for us today. So what does Jesus require? He says, if any man, anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. That's a pretty high price. Any way you cut it, there's no way to soft sell this message. There's literally no way you can soft sell it. Jesus says the first requirement is going to cost you your people. Now, they had visions of grandeur, to be sure, but Jesus had to stop them short because he was proceeding to build a kingdom and to wage war. And he needed people who would be around to finish the task. Now, there's a humorous Irish song. I heard it in the 60s from a somewhat popular Canadian folk rock group called the Irish Rovers. You might be familiar with the Unicorn song that came from the Irish Rovers. Well, they had another popular song. It's called The Orange and the Green. And you got to have at least a rudimentary history or a rudimentary understanding of Irish history. Sorry I didn't have time to ask you, Brian. Anybody know what this is? Irish flag. Okay, we got three colors here. We got the orange. What does that stand for? Protestants in Northern Ireland. What does the green stand for? The Catholics in Southern Ireland. Now, you know when the red and the orange and the green mix, they don't mix too well. So you better have a neutral color in between. I think this plague has been well thought out through the ages. Now, there's a lot going on in Northern Ireland, and it has a lot more, or Ireland as a whole, and it has a lot more to do with just the difference between Protestants and Catholics. And I'll try not to butcher this song. This will be the only time you hear me sing a solo. And I'll try and put my Irish brogue on, and it would be a lot better if you actually had the music to it. Okay. Oh, it is the biggest mix-up that you have ever seen. My father, he was orange, and me mother, she was green. My father was an Ulster man, proud Protestant was he. My mother was a Catholic girl from County Cork was she. They were married in two churches and lived happily enough until the day that I was born. Then things got rather tough. Baptized by Father Riley, I was then rushed away by car to be made a little orangeman, my father's shining star. I was christened David Anthony, but still, in spite of that, to my father I was William, and my mother called me Pat. Oh, it was the greatest mix-up that you have ever seen. My father, he was orange, and me mother, she was green. With mother every Sunday to Mass I'd proudly stroll. Then after that, the Orange Lodge would try to save my soul. For both sides tried to claim me, but I was smart because I'd play the flute or play the harp, depending where I was. Now when I'd sing those rebel songs, much to my mother's joy, my father would jump up and say, "Look here, would you, me boy? That's quite enough of that lot." He'd then toss me a coin, and he'd have me sing the Orange Flute or the Heroes of the Boyne. Oh, it was the greatest mix-up that you have ever seen. My father, he was orange, and me mother, she was green. One day my ma's relations came around to visit me, just as my father's kinfolk were all sitting down to tea. We tried to smooth things over, but they all began to fight. And me, being strictly neutral, I kicked everyone in sight. My parents never could agree about my type of school. My learning was all done at home, that's why I'm such a fool. They both passed on, God rest them, but left me caught between that awful color problem of the orange and the green. Oh, it was the greatest mix-up that you have ever seen. My father, he was orange, and my mother, she was green. Now, you should try that sometime, especially with a voice as bad as mine. Now, we all laugh at that, but you can imagine somebody caught in that type of scenario. And many people were, if a Catholic married a Protestant in Ireland. And many people are caught in that type of scenario around the world throughout history, and some in some cultures even today. But sometimes you have to pay a price between mother and father. See, the early Christians, Jesus, as he's beginning, he's in the third year of his ministry. He's about 6 months away from the cross and the resurrection when all these crowds are following him. You think of all the miracles that he performed. You know, we get details of only a few dozen healings, but you read the scriptures carefully, you begin to realize that Jesus literally healed thousands. Some days he just spent all day healing people, or would use the healing and then at the end of the day begin to teach. There were so many people following him because he had healed them or driven out demons from their son or their daughter. He had a wealth, a deep pool of love and affection. But he was always sifting the people down, down, down to those who would pay the ultimate price. So in less than 20 years, these people were going to face Jewish persecution. And in less than 40 years, they were going to face Roman persecution with the rise of Nero and subsequent emperors. And they paid, many of them, literally by the thousands, if you read Fox's Books of Martyrs, literally thousands paid with their life. Let's break it down. Father and mother. You can hold your place there in Luke 14. Turn to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10 as a whole is the best commentary on Luke chapter 14, but we're not going to read all of Matthew chapter 10. We'll pick apart a few passages here and there. Father and mother, Matthew chapter 10, verse 34 through 36. Jesus said, "Do not think I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies would be the members of his own household." Mentioned before, there was missionaries on campus at OBC one time, and they were from India. And he was talking about one young man that he had immersed into Christ. And the first thing that young man did, he was prepared before his immersion, and as soon as he was immersed, he tailed it to the mountains to get away from his dad, because he knew his dad would come to kill him if he found out that he had converted to Christianity. You know, the picture a lot of people like to paint out there about multiculturalism and all the religions getting along. Well, you try preaching Christianity in some of these countries, you'll find out they don't like it very well at all. You're going to upset the apple cart. You're messing with the status quo. It's more than just mono-mono. You're going against an entire culture to preach Christianity in a Muslim country, or in a Hindu country, or a Buddhist country. You have a picture of monks, you know, these guys, you know, look at the Dalai Lama and all that. A lot of those guys have been known to be very violent. Don't kid yourself. But father or mother, some cultures, they'll actually hold a funeral if someone converts to a different religion. And from that point on, that person is dead. In Jewish culture, there was a movie, I don't know how many movies, you know, a lot of these people make their fame in another genre, and so they decide they'll try and act, like Jennifer Lopez, or in this case, Neil Diamond. But Neil Diamond, about 15, 20 years ago, was in a movie called The Jazz Singer. And the idea was, as he got into music, he was moving away from his Jewish roots. And his father finally gave up in exasperation and reached and tore his pocket on his shirt. See, that's what they would do a lot of times in Orthodox Jewish circles. If a family member abdicates Judaism and converts to another faith, they'll tear a garment to indicate that something has been torn from them. And from that point on, it doesn't matter if they see you walking down the street. "Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Hey." Walk right by. You're dead. A dead person isn't going to go, "Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. You're dead." They won't even acknowledge you. You know, that's a pretty steep price to pay, especially when there's a close relationship between mom and dad. We see an example in John chapter 9 and the parents of the man born blind. They were such cowards. They should have been rejoicing that their son had been born blind and been blind for all these many years. But when the Pharisees called them in, they came in with fear and trembling. "Hey, we don't know how he got healed. Ask him. He's of age." Sometimes parents are like that. You'll never know who will turn on you for sure when the screws are put to the metal. Now, when I became a Christian, the week before, actually, it was Saturday evening, which when I was taking a look at the Jules Miller film strips when I was 18 years old, and I called my dad and stepmother up to tell them I was going to be baptized the next day. My stepmother said, "Well, you were probably baptized as an infant." And I said, "Well, that doesn't count." Well, I could hear the steam coming over the phone line. Well, I wasn't particularly concerned with what my stepmother thought because we never had a good relationship. So I've never had to worry. I've never had to face that family dilemma of what's my family going to think, or what kind of heat are they bringing against me if I commit and take a stand for Jesus Christ. So, I mean, in all honesty, I have a tough time even relating to this, the parent part. Now, if I'd had time, I would have asked everybody in here who is a Christian who's come from a non-Christian family. And I'm sure some of you could tell a tale or two about a little displeasure on your parents' part. But Jesus says, "Look, you got to love me more than anybody in the entire world." So this is a very real problem for many people. And then he says, wife and children. Oh, that's tough. That I can relate to. Matthew 10:21, we're right there in Matthew, so we may as well stick there. Jesus says, brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. You will be hated by all because of my name, but it is the one who has endured to the end who will be saved. Now that would be a heartbreaker for me. I mean, to think you have your own child, the one that in your womb, in the middle of the night, mom would elbow dad and say, hey, the baby's kicking. Feel it? Oh, a tremendous thrill. It's been so long, I have a tough time remembering. But that is a tremendous thrill. And then that anticipation, waiting for the child to be born. Now, in my experience, nothing, even my immersion in Christ or my marriage, was as great as witnessing the birth of each of my children. And then playing with them and nurturing them and teaching them. And then coming to a type of situation in a given culture where the pressure would be so hot that your child would give you up, point you out, and it would cause your death. Man, that would be tough to take. Your own child betraying you. A lot of times, wives and husbands in churches have a tough time because the wife is a Christian, the husband's not. And sometimes it's the other way around. And most Christian churches out there, as I mentioned before, you have more wives in the church without Christian husbands. But interestingly enough, in our fellowship, the congregations we're familiar with, there's more men who are Christians and their wives are not. And I think there's a reason for that. But you know, that's got to be tough. That's your soulmate, mate. That's the one you got to live with every single day. And one's for Christ and the other one's not. One's interested and the other one's not. That's got to be a challenge. You see, if somebody else rebuffs my overtures, if I'm trying to talk to them about Christ, I usually don't have to see them very often. If they're a stranger, I'll probably never see them again. But my wife, I'd have to live with her every single day. That'd be tough to take if she wasn't committed to Christ. Speaking of my wife, I couldn't have made it a lot of times. If it wasn't for my wife and my kids, I couldn't have made it. I remember a gal named Lois Cromlick in Wolf Creek. She'd been a Jehovah's Witness for years. And when I became a Christian in Great Falls, they had moved to Great Falls, and I just happened to run into her. Well, she'd fallen away. She wasn't interested in religion at all. I was trying talking to her. Well, see, her husband was never, ever interested. So she finally caved in to that pressure. See, how much pressure would it take for you to give up on Christ? Mama pressure? Papa pressure? Wife pressure? Children pressure? Then Jesus says, brothers and sisters. You know, a couple months ago, Jay mentioned the Korean couple. And in the context of doing away with idolism in their particular discussion or Bible study. And they say, well, you know, we've got a problem. Every year, our family comes together and we have pictures of the ancestors. What are they doing? They're worshiping idols. They're worshiping their ancestors. They're worshiping idols. No prayers for those ancestors. No prayers to those ancestors. Are you going to do one drop of good? Jay said, well, I guess you got a decision to make. Now, I don't know if Jay knows what decision they made. I certainly don't. I pray that they made the right decision. But the point I'm making is, for a lot of people, a lot of families, a lot of cultures, this is real. If it's not real to you in particular, I guarantee you it's a lot of people. It's a big hurdle. You think of Mormons. Now, Mormons have made a lot of converts for sure, but I guarantee you, 19 out of 20, when the elders come to your door, I've probably entertained a dozen through the years, and I've only had one that wasn't born into a Mormon family. So you start talking to them about Christ and make a reasoned presentation, and I do. I do make a very reasoned presentation. I don't shut the door on them. I invite them in. I invite them in with the head honchos, had them in a couple times. You know, I made enough mistakes, I halfway know what I'm doing now. But I put a real dent in their testimony. But you know, they're making this mental calculation. You know, if I go with the truth and I repudiate Mormonism, I'm giving up the favor of my mom and dad, my brothers and sisters, my entire culture, and I'm giving up all the bennies. Make no mistake, there's plenty of bennies with being part of the Mormon community. And I'm giving up all those benefits. And they're making this quick mental calculation, and they're deciding the price is too high. Now, there's one important misconception. Jesus is not saying to disavow your family. Jesus doesn't want a bunch of monks and nuns going off to the monastery, and in their artificial devotion to God, they're denying themselves and their family, contemplating their non-existent spiritual navel. That's not what he wants. And we know that in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus says the very same thing in essence. He says, anyone who loves father or mother, brother or sister, wife, etc., more than me. He's not saying hate your family. He's not saying disavow them. He's simply saying, if it comes to push, come to shove, it's Christ first, last, and always. Whether anybody goes along, any of your people, your parents, your brothers, your sisters, your siblings, your wife, your children, your culture. If you have to make a choice, that choice should have already been made. We know it because in 1 Corinthians 9:5, Paul talking about his apostleship, he says, don't we have a right to take along a believing wife like Peter and the rest of the apostles? Peter sometimes took his wife along on evangelistic trips. Now, so much for celibacy of priests. I mean, it's like goose, like gander, right? What's good for the goose, good for the gander. If the Pope can have a wife, then the priests can certainly have a wife. Matthew chapter 15, Jesus condemned the Pharisees. They said, hey, how come you aren't keeping the traditions of the elder? And he says, hey, how come you aren't keeping the law for the sake of your tradition? The law said you take care of your mom and your dad in your old age. You guys got this tradition called Corbin. Hey, mom and dad, the money I'm setting aside for your old age, well, I've devoted it to God. Well, I bet you those guys were, tell you what, you give a little money to the kitty here, and I'll give a little money to the kitty here, and we'll all benefit from the pooled kitty. But see, he was condemning them for not taking care of their parents in their old age. Genesis chapter 2. The greatest illustration, the two shall become one flesh. That's the single biggest illustration as God has created, the marriage between a man and a woman to illustrate the love between Christ and His church. So we know, in perspective, God's not saying hate your family, disavow your family. He's just saying, if the family goes one way, you've got to go with Christ, no matter what it costs you. Mom, dad, brothers, sisters, children, or wife. Now, Jesus put it in terms of hate in order to create a contrast. It's just like in John chapter 6, after he'd fed the 5,000, everybody came running to him and said, you're seeking me for the wrong reason. You want food. You want more bread. He said, you got to eat the bread that's coming down out of heaven. They said, oh, Lord, give us this bread. He said, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in yourself. And he put it in those terms so that if somebody wanted an excuse to go away, they would. On that occasion, most of them did. So he put it in terms of hate your family. So if someone's looking for an excuse to hop off the boat, get off the train, they could. Hey, man, this guy's crazy. See, it's a choice. I want to tell you a little secret for you parents, for your kids. Yeah, I realize right now when you're a young parent, they're your little bundle of joy. But you only get them for a very short time. You can hold on to them as tightly as you want. You mothers, you can gently press your fingers through your sleeping baby's hair with that tenderness and that love that you have for them. Dad, you can wrestle with the boys on the carpet, but you only get them for so long. Hold on to them all you want, but you can't keep them unless you give them away to Christ. Now, I'll tell you a secret. You give your kids to Jesus, and He'll give them back. He'll give them back. But it won't be in this life. It'll be in glory. But are you giving your children to Jesus? Are you praying for them every day? Are you praying with them? Dad, who does the devotions? It's too easy to have mom do it. 10 minutes? 15 minutes? Read a biblical story to your kids? Is that too much, Dad? Too busy? Hobby or pursuit or extra work? Is that more important? Are you really giving your kids to Jesus? Are you creating a vision in your mind? You know, it's a tremendous blessing for Hank and Peggy to have Tom and Marcia here, and in turn to have all the grandkids here. There's nothing wrong with that. But we should be creating visions in our children's mind of Luke going to Japan as a missionary. And maybe they wouldn't see that boy for 2 years, because that happens sometimes. See, what type of vision are you creating for your children and your grandchildren? You have this picture that you're trying to fulfill of just holding them tight for as long as you live? Let them go. Give them to Jesus. I guarantee you, by the one who has kept every promise, He will give them back. And that's the only way you'll get to keep them. You also have to give up your person. Jesus said, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And if anyone does not carry his own cross and come after me, he cannot be his disciple. Again, that little extra punch to drive it home. So there's no question, no equivocation. So you have to give up your own person as well as your own people. Now, for some people, leaving the family is no problem. If you never had a family, if you were an orphan, or you had a rocky relationship with your parents, some people leaving the family behind is no big deal. Some people is constant turmoil, so leaving brother and sister behind, no big deal. Some people leaving the wife behind, or even the kids, might not be any big deal. The second chiropractor I ever went to, I started asking him questions as he was working on my back and wrenching my neck. And you know, those guys give you that thorough massage, and he's rubbing his thumb up your back and then into your neck, and you get this huge knot there, and you go, you're thinking subconsciously, I'm not sure I ever want to do this again. But I was asking him questions about his wife, and he said, yeah, I used to be married. I've been divorced for 6 years. I was married for 14 years, six of the happiest years of my life. I meant last 8 years weren't so happy. So in that type of situation, might not be any big deal to leave the family behind. So Jesus jacks it up a notch. He says you've got to leave yourself behind. Now, the family is not always a given. Family may go along. But you, that's no given. You have to. Under every circumstance, all circumstances, you have to carry your own cross. No one else can do it for you. Mark chapter 8. Most of our commentaries right here out of the Gospels. Mark chapter 8. Eight thirty-four out of Mark. And he summoned the crowd with his disciples and said to them, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his life? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father and his holy angels. You know, some people want to be a big fish in a small pond. You know, council member. Some people want to be a big fish in a bigger pond. Governor, state representative. Some people want to be the biggest fish in the biggest pond. President of the United States. Some people will sell their soul just for a little more money. Another rung up on the ladder to advance their career. You know, most people don't sell their soul for the entire world. They sell their soul for just a little piece of it. How cheaply the average man or woman sells his own soul. Jesus said, you gain everything, you lose it all. But if you're willing to lose it for my sake and for the gospel's, you will keep it. Again, a guarantee from the one who has fulfilled every promise and has proved that he has the power to deliver by raising himself from the dead. You know, sometimes we're so used to the resurrection, we don't put it in perspective. I was just thinking about Paul before King Agrippa. And the Roman governor cries out, he says, your great learning, Paul, has made you mad. What elicited that response? He said, Paul's last statement was, why is it so surprising among you that God should raise the dead? That's never happened. Do you understand that? Not Genghis Khan, not Hitler, not Stalin, none of the Caesars, not Harry Houdini. There's only one person that is raised from the dead. Death has claimed every man, every woman, every boy, Jack, and every girl, Jill. Everyone. And only one has conquered the grave to demonstrate to you and I conclusively that he has the power to fulfill his promises. So if you lose your life for his sake, you will find it. What price do you put on your life? He gave two. Well, let me talk about this. I remember my struggle as an 18-year-old. As I hit my teenage years, I heard enough of Billy Graham. I'd had enough exposure to the gospel. I didn't go to any particular church, but I just had enough exposure. I was afraid of dying because I knew where I'd go. I'd go to hell. But I wasn't ready to commit my life to Jesus Christ. So my brother and sister going to Great Falls Christian Church, sometimes I'd go. I really didn't want to go. I liked the preaching, good preacher. Harold Hammond was a good preacher. Didn't have much conviction, but he was a good preacher. And that invitation would be given. And man, it was just like a vice around my chest. I knew I should go forward, but I didn't quite want to give my life to Christ. Well, let me ask you a question. Do you think Jesus died on the cross because he wants you to be unhappy? Think about it. It's just that he knows what will make you happy in the long run for both time and eternity. And that's sacrificing yourself, losing it for his sake. But Jesus uses two illustrations, the one of the tower. It's called, a lot of times, you think in terms of counting the cost. This is a passage about counting the cost. He says, you know, if you're going to build a tower, you first sit down and you consider whether you got enough to complete it. Now, do you have enough to complete it? See, God doesn't want people rushing into Christianity. He doesn't want you conning somebody, getting them to rub the magic lamp or sign on the dotted line or ask Jesus into their heart and presto, once you're saved, you can never be lost. Eternal security doesn't work that way. No, he wants disciplined followers. Go into all the world and make disciples. A disciplined follower. Someone who's willing to pay the price. And then he uses the example of war. Or what king, when he sets out to go to war against another king, does not first sit down and consider whether with 10,000 men he has enough to go against the one who's coming against him with 20. Or else, while the other is still far away, he'll send a delegation and ask for terms of peace. Now, there's two ways to take this. I've seen a third way, but it just doesn't fit. The first way is the way you've probably most often heard it. And the idea is that the second illustration is another example, the first illustration. In other words, you got a king sitting down, and boy, we got 20,000 coming against us. Men, we got to give it all, but we're not going to make it. But I'd like to suggest that it's just the opposite. What Jesus is saying is you got to pay a price. You got to give up everything you got. But what you got isn't enough. You've got to surrender. Now, conventional warfare, when you got one army lining up on one side of the field and the other army lining up on this side of the field, and you got 10,000 going against 20,000, the 10,000 are going to get slaughtered. They're going to get annihilated. They're going to get their heads chopped off. They're going to get the sword thrust through their belly in conventional warfare. If my understanding is correct, then Jesus is the king who's far off. In which case, God would be saying, when you go against me, you're not going to win. So don't even think about it. The best thing you can do is, while I'm still far away, in other words, before the day of judgment comes, you better sue for terms of peace. What do you do in that situation if you're a king? You give up. You say, I'm at your mercy. What are your terms? Exact tribute. Whatever you want. Make my people slaves. Whatever you want. See, you would have to surrender. You'd have to give up. And that's scary, isn't it? Because you don't know what that other king's going to do to you. Now, surrender is a vastly different concept, catch this, than working for your salvation. Because if you're working for your salvation, a lot of people out there are, you never know when you've given enough, when you've sacrificed enough, when you've put enough in the offering plate, when you've cared for the poor enough. You never know if God is satisfied yet. You never know if you've paid the price yet. There's always more you could give, always more you could do. And so you never have that security that you've earned your salvation. Jesus says, what you got to do is surrender. You see, it's a different concept. All you got to do is give up. Just like the fictitious character in The Orange and the Green. You know, he'd play the flute or play the harp, depending on where he was. Well, if you're interested in truth, you can't do that. But see, the beauty of it, you don't have to worry about pleasing somebody else. You only have one person to please when you surrender your life to Jesus Christ. And that's Him. Now, there may be a price for displeasing other people, but you don't have to worry being jockeyed back and forth. Who do I please? You know, what do they want to hear now? So you only have to please one person. So surrender is a vastly different concept. See, the idea is you have to give it all, but your all isn't enough. So just give up. Give in. And give out to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. And then Jesus sums it up this way. So then, none of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. Now, we could talk about possessions, but really all Jesus is doing is just issuing a summary statement. He's saying you have to give up your people, your family, if necessary. You have to give up your life, and that is absolutely necessary. You have to take up your own cross. No one else can do it for you. And you have to give up everything else that goes in between. That's your possessions. I've got a question for you. We all know intellectually that what God has given us, we are stewards of. In other words, we don't own it. We're responsible for it. And we have to give an account for our stewardship before God on the day of judgment. But we know that. But let me ask you a question. What is your first instinctive thought when you think of home, family, car, business, money? Is it my home? My family? My business, my money, my possessions? What about your life? Is it my life? Don't be preaching to me. As a song in the 60s said, of rebellion, you can't run your own life, so you blanky well aren't going to run mine. It's my life, and I'll do whatever I want with it. See, when you think of all those areas, in all honesty, the wording you speak to yourself, your own self-language, what is your instinctive reaction? Mine or God's? Now, there's a second misconception here that could be had. Jesus is not talking about sacrifice for sacrifice's sake. God doesn't want people running to be martyrs. That's not what he's talking about. Matthew chapter 19, this will be our last text. Matthew 19, verse 27. There's a natural question that every person asks. I don't care how unselfish you are. You ask the same question that Peter asks right here. Matthew chapter 19, verse 27. Then Peter said to him, "Behold, we have left everything and followed you. What then will there be for us?" And Jesus said to them, "Truly I say to you that you have followed me in the regeneration when the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne. You also shall sit upon 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or farms for my name's sake will receive many times as much and will inherit eternal life. But many who are first will be last, and the last first." It's like someone said, it's Jesus first, others second, and you last. And we all know that, but do we all really believe that? I could say, do we all really act that? But the action follows the belief. Do we all really believe that? Is that our picture of reality? Jesus first, others second, myself last. Now, the picture I have of the prodigal son, you know there's three central characters in the story of the prodigal son. Earlier in Luke, the lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost son. There's the father, there's the wayward son, and then there's the son that was faithful who became jealous. We're not going to deal with the last figure. Now, here's a picture in my mind. I don't know why, just an automatic picture. I have a picture of this road down the hill, lined with trees, and then the farmstead is right down there in the middle. Lush meadowland. This guy's got a big spread. He's got flocks, he's got herds, he's got servants, he's got slaves. And the youngest son comes along and says, "Hey, Dad, I don't want to wait for you to kick the bucket. Give me my inheritance now." And so he went away, and we know the rest of the story. He wasted his money on wine, women, and song. And then he ended up feeding the hogs, which was totally repugnant to the Jewish people, unclean animal. And the hogs were eating better than he was. And he finally came to his senses and said, "This is stupid. You know, my father's slaves are doing better than I am. Better clothing, better food. I'm going to go back to my dad and say, 'Dad, I'm not worthy to be called your son. Just make me a slave.'" See, when he came to his senses, he was willing to surrender his life to the will of his father. What about Dad? I can guarantee you, when that boy went away, Dad went away and found a secret place and cried his heart out. And then he washed his face and he went about his business. But every day, he'd look up that road. And if he saw somebody coming, his heart would beat faster. Is that? No, it's just the neighbor. Just some traders. One day, after days and weeks and months, perhaps a year or two of hoping, he's probably dealing with a servant or a slave there, maybe setting a seal to an official document to sell or buy something. He's not paying attention. And one of the slaves says, "Look, it's Jonathan." And he drops everything and he looks up. He's going to make sure, he doesn't want to be disappointed again. And it is! And he goes running after him. And he meets him and he embraces him. And the boy says, "Dad." He's not sure what Dad's going to do. Maybe beat him to a pulp. But, "Dad, I'm not worthy to be called your son. Just make me a slave or less than a slave." The dad's not hearing a single word. He says, "Round up the family. Round up the slaves. Stop all the work. Bring the fatted calf. Bring the royal robe. Bring the finest shoes. We're going to have a party." See, everything the father wants to give to the son. See, God wants to give everything to you. Do you understand that? Everything. His glory. Paul said the eye has not seen and the ear has not heard. In other words, you can't imagine big enough for what God is going to give to those who love Him. You got to focus on the reward. He wants to give you everything. In Matthew chapter 13, you have the parables of the kingdom. Tremendous, tremendous passage. But in the midst of those parables, there's two parables that Jesus tells. He says, "The kingdom of heaven is like someone who finds a treasure hidden in a field. And he covers it up, and he goes and he sells all that he has in order to purchase the field and the treasure that's inside." And then he follows that with another parable. He says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls. And he finds one of great value, so valuable that he sells all that he has to buy this one single pearl." Now, the picture I get of the first illustration, it's as though somebody's just walking along, maybe they're kicking a rock, and they discover this treasure when they start digging. A lot of people, they don't necessarily look for Christianity, but it sort of finds them. That's the way I was. Now, other people are looking for it. They're looking for the truth. Take a look at Mormonism. Doesn't fit. Hinduism. Doesn't fit. This ism, that ism. Doesn't fit. And somebody brings the gospel to them. That's what I've been looking for. But the key ingredient, according to the parable, is they sold everything. Everything. Wanting to make sure that they bought that field with that found treasure and bought that pearl of great price. Now, this to me is one of the most sobering texts in all the Bible. Far more sobering than texts about hell. And they do catch my attention, but this one more. Because this challenges me and my commitment to Jesus Christ. Can't make it easier for you. Can't make it easier for me. The question is, what price do you put on glory? And what price do you put on your own eternal life? Because they parallel. If heaven means that much to you, then your eternity means that much to you, that you will give it all up to gain eternity. As someone has said, "He is no fool who gives up that which he cannot keep in order to gain that which he can never lose." He is no fool who gives up that which he cannot keep in order to gain that which he can never lose. Owning nothing, gaining everything, a bargain at any price.